previously on Worlds Away.
The Spectre was in pursuit of the ghost ship, and it crash-landed here on Consus. I think it might still be here.
Sending coordinates of the Grizz to the two of you now. Leela and I will be here, ready to go.
On my way.
At this point, it appears that you're approaching the area where the Penna were circling. And if you look up, you can see what appears to be a tear in the treetops. And in the middle of the clearing, you can see one of the Penna slumped on the ground with one of its wings covering it like a blanket.
Mara is going to hop on the Grizz and pull out her sniper rifle.
Okay.
Ooh.
She's going to get in position.
I think Leela senses there's an opportunity here to maybe dart in and try to maybe heal this broken wing. That's a 9.
Nice.
Mixed success.
What does it look like as you reach the creature? Can you describe the scene?
I think she gently puts her hands on its back or another seemingly uninjured part of it. We see its body kind of visibly shift a little bit and maybe not look quite so broken.
I think that Mara is putting the Grizz on like sentry mode.
I think I'm just testing Mara's perimeter then and trying to get some feedback as around the ring of trees.
Cassandra.
So we're finally going to catch the ghost ship.
I think the Lustra is the key. But I think we already knew that.
Well, if that's all then.
Nasir, wait. I know I fucked up. I know it will never be the same with the four of us. I know I can't fix it.
Why haven't you apologized?
I don't know.
You're right that an apology won't fix it. But you don't apologize to fix it. You apologize because it's the least you can do.
I think as you, the last person, and maybe it's Leela's the final one to get her feet on the ground, as you set your feet down into the bottom of the gorge, I think you see that the ecosystem down here is extremely different from what was in the forest above, even though you're only separated by just the height of this.
I would like to pull out Scanning Reborn.
I think that what you notice is movement at the bend in the gorge. And I think initially your reaction might be that this is some kind of flood, or maybe more accurately a mudslide, given the color of the flow that you see moving toward you. But as you start to feel a light vibration in the ground, I think you can see breaks in the river of this movement that are coming toward you. And you realize that this flood is actually a mass of the Molkin that we saw earlier.
Oh, no.
Jesus.
Stampede! But a little cute.
Welcome to Worlds Away, an actual play storytelling podcast. I'm your game master, John Ossip, and here with me, we have Haley Daria.
We're ASMR today.
Lauren Wilbanks.
Spring maxing.
Michael Morales.
What is spring maxing?
And Moshe
you
Dara.
Already know.
Hello, listeners. I gotta be honest, I don't really like the voice. Can we do something else?
No, okay, let's fix it. Let's fix it. It's fine.
All right.
Damn.
Welcome to World's Away. I knew you guys were going to retreat. Honestly, we'll keep it. Keep it with the voice switch, with the complaint in there. We'll just dive right in.
So, When we last left off, the four of you heard a crack or explosion echo through the gorge, and that was followed by what looked like a flood or mudslide barreling toward you. But as that, I guess, shape or flow approaches you, you can actually see that the flood is in fact a stampede of what we've been calling the Mulkin. Lauren, you had been using your scanner and saw that in the bubble-like depressions in the cliff walls, some of those depressions extend into caves that lead toward the other side of this dog-leg shape in the gorge, and those would be off to the right side of where you're standing. And so my question for all of you now is, what are you doing to avoid this stampede? And if you're trying to make it to those openings in the wall, what are you doing to get there?
Can we tell definitively where we are, like which opening will take us to the other side, or is this a guessing game?
I think that Mara, I should say, from your scanner, right? You can tell that three of them on the right side lead into a cave structure. I think in terms of what the inside of that looks like, I don't think that you have a good indication from the outside, Mike, but I think that you can tell that those three are kind of interconnected in this cave structure that goes into the wall of the cliff.
Okay.
And I think you can tell which ones those are. I mean, again, Mara with their scanner can tell which ones that is.
So I think we should theoretically aim for the like most accessible one, right?
Mm-hmm.
I assume, so we're trying to like almost scrabble out of this kind of cut gorge that we're in. Is it like the Lion King?
Ooh.
I'm trying to remember that scene, but...
Where Mufasa dies?
Yeah. Because in my head, what I assume we're going to have to do is kind of climb out of here.
I think it's similar, right? I think the big difference is you have on the sides, you have these like pockets into the wall, right? You know, how long those will last for, what you need to do to move up, I think that's the question. But I think really it's like, are you going for one of those cave entrances? I mean, it sounds like the consensus is yes. If it is, then what are you doing to move there from where you are, which is kind of in the middle of the gorge right now? And it's not a, I don't think it's just a barren canyon, right? There are ledges and foliage on the inside of this. And I mentioned a very narrow stream kind of going down the center here, but one that you could easily walk over. And Laura, I think you had mentioned the trying to go for the lowest one. And those depressions I mentioned, they're kind of like bubbles in the wall of this rock, right? Like almost, it might be like a half or three quarters of a sphere that's been removed. What was in there, what caused it, I don't think it's clear to you. The lowest one, the one that's closest to the bottom, is like if you kind of put them in layers, like 2.5 up from the bottom. So I think you'd have to do some scrambling to get up to it.
If that's the case, then I want to discharge Juggernaut. You move forward unflinching towards a goal through an immediate danger or hazard that others cower from, discharge this move and roll plus stalwart.
And I am cowering.
So let me ask this, though, before you do that, and maybe this is just more descriptive. So, I mean, Mara, you detected this stuff on your scanner, right? But if Arno is going to act on this information, how does it look like when you share that? Is it like on the HUD in his helmet? Like how do you share that information with everybody and point them in the results of your scope it out roll that you did last episode?
Yeah, I think that, you know, maybe I'm imagining Mara was just about to kind of share her information, and then we had the imminent trampling. So I think instead of a long verbose description, she'll probably very quickly pull out the most essential points of the data and kind of throw it up on everyone's like HUD, like you said. And so I think that we see different topographical, like the crevices that you're describing. And then like maybe there's some sort of calculation where it's like ease of accessibility, 70%, 40%, 10%, blah, blah, blah.
I like that. Okay, so Mike, go ahead and roll plus stalwart, and we will see what happens.
10.
Hell yeah.
Great start. On a 10 plus, you are unstoppable, choose 2, and I'm going to pick from the list. You clear or uncover a way for an ally, they have advantage going forward following you, and you unquestionably reach your goal.
Okay.
Awesome.
So how is Arno transiting the space? What does this look like?
So I think the first thing that Arno is going to do is take out his shield, and it's a little bit bigger, bulkier type situation. And I think he sees like a gap in the ridge. And as he's running, He's just trying to wedge it in there so that we have something to run on top of, like, over like a very small, or maybe.
I was also interested in the shield because I kind of had, I think we had described it before, maybe in the rule book, and I'm not saying that we have to stick with that. It's like a kind of like dune shield, right? Where it's over your whole body and it's kind of a force field. But if it's like yours is like a, you know, D&D shield, I mean, that's interesting, right? I just want to kind of know, like, what that looks like.
I always understood it as like sort of like if there was like a centerpiece over here, it was like an energy shield type thing that just kind of like appears and like has the rough shape and dimensions of a shield, but if it
I like that. I mean, I'm fine with that. Okay. That could be.
It's a Breath of the Wild Guardian shield.
Yeah, there we go. That's what I'm thinking here. Oh, I really like that because then I can just like pick it back up as we cross so that something else wouldn't be able to like follow the same way.
So you're using that to make a path across so you can kind of use it to bridge the
like
edge.
I'm using it to like rush forward through like any like thicket or like thin trees or like or just any like foliage over here that's like easily trampled, and then we see a gap.
Okay.
And then I'll use it to like create like an ersatz little, I don't even call it a bridge, but like a little walkway over there, and then I'll just take it back up behind us.
Okay. So I think you do that, and I think you kind of charge across that stream I mentioned in the bottom of the gorge here, and I think that you use the shield to push through several of the sort of small shrubs or like little trees that are on the ground level, and you're kind of like almost literally opening a path, I think, that somebody could follow you. I think that when you get to the edge of the rocks, right, you begin to climb, and I think the ground is starting to shake with the movement. I think that you get pelted with a few falling rocks. You do not take the, if you take harm, take one less. So I think you do take one harm from getting pelted. But I think that you do open a path for an ally to follow you. My question for you is, which ally do you open that path for?
I'm going to go with Mara, since she has the most information about where to proceed.
Okay.
Suck it, losers. I'm living.
Well, I guess let me ask that to the rest of you. Do all three of you run after Arno?
I mean, I'm not staying to get trampled.
Or do you have some other plan?
I mean, I think my instinct here is just to move, right? So if Arno picks a direction, I'm following.
Okay. So I think, Arno, you get to the edge of the rocks and you are moving your way up. And I think you kind of leap and use the arm hooks on your suit to grab the ledges. And I think you make your way up to the second and then to the third level, which is the one that Mara had indicated had the 78% probability of ease of transit or whatever the statistic was that was up on your HUD. And I think, Mara, you kind of scramble up and follow. However, as you reach the top of that and grab a hold of the ledge, I think in scrambling up, you knock down some of that rock and I think have removed the handhold that maybe Leela and Nasir could use to easily follow you. So I think Leela and Nasir, at this time, you're making your way across the bottom of the gorge and are kind of reaching the edge where those bubbles in the wall are starting to form. What do you do to try to follow them up? Do you have any tools on you that you can use, or do you have some other strategy to make your way up the rock rather than just sort of following in the same path that Arno and Mara took?
I mean, I have a tactical pack, so I guess I could try to pull some sort of spike or something out that we could use to like clamber up on top of to kind of give us a boost.
I think you could do that, and I think you could use that to replace the handhold. So if you want to try that, you could give it a shot.
Okay.
I guess the question I have for you though is, what's the move? Is it act quick or is it
I mean, I think it would be act quick just because I feel like there's a lot of pressure bearing down on us and there's literally Mulkin bearing down on us. So
and I'll just say this, I'm fine with the kind of practical thing. If there's like cool, like if you think you would do something cool in this situation, like Nasir, if you want to use your hoverboard to skate on top of these things, that is totally an option for you. I'm not trying to hold you back. This is like a chance to just pick a move to try to get up here. So
I don't have a hoverboard yet, unfortunately.
Oh, damn. Oops.
I thought you said I needed to do one more segment.
Oh, yeah. All right. My bad. I'm sorry. I'm a dictator.
I mean, okay. If this fails, I'll try to vibes them.
Okay. I think that's fine. You can use the tactical pack. Go ahead and roll act quick. Let me see how this goes.
And so the tactical pack gives me... What does it give me?
You have the tool that you need to do this.
Okay.
So.
It gives me... I get to roll.
Yeah. Okay. Without like having another option.
Well, I failed. That's a six.
Okay. Go ahead and mark XP.
Excellent.
So I think I'm going to kind of set a clock on this. and say that there are three ticks until the mole can reach the location that you're in at this point. And so one of those ticks is now eliminated and that there's two left. Leela, you go and try to hammer the spike into the wall. And how are you climbing up that? Were you just using your hand? Like, oh, I'll put this in and then climb up? Or did you have a rope? What was the strategy that you're using to get up there?
Yeah, I mean, I would think that maybe the spike comes with some rope. And I mean, maybe it's like a pair of spikes and there's rope that connects them. And okay. So you can kind of put one spike in and then climb on top of that and then put the second spike in. But I don't know, maybe I like put the first spike in, but I like can't hold on, or I don't push it in well enough to be able to stand on it.
Yeah, I think you put the spike in and then if you have the rope, you go and put your weight on it. Or maybe you put the second spike in, right? So you have one in and that one stays. And then the second one, you go to switch the weight to that second spike and mm-hmm. it snaps out and you fall down the height of one of those bubbles, mm-hmm. which is probably like 7 feet up, and hit the floor of the canyon or the gorge. Go ahead and take one harm also. Nasir, your turn. You just saw Leela fall in front of you. I guess, what do you do? Do you kind of take yourself out of the situation, or do you do anything to go back for her?
I have a question. Leela, you were, like, setting pitons as you were going with your tactical path. Like, you were climbing, you were creating your own path. I'm not going to be able to stop her from taking the harm, right? But narratively, mm-hmm. what I would like to do, if she's setting pitons and I'm climbing behind her, I want to try to catch her as she falls.
Oh, Ooh. Yeah, I think I'm okay with retconning that. How do you do that? Just reach out quickly to grab her is the instinct? I'm kind of willing to take it either way. Is it act quick, or is it about your strength of holding the rope or something like that? And therefore is more stalwart. I guess probably act quick benefits you because you're slick, right?
Yeah.
You think you're slick.
I definitely think it's act quick, but I'm actually just checking to see if it's something else.
Yeah, if you got a cool move, I'm all about it.
When you're a pioneer, but were previously an icon, and your former friend, now coworker, it's complicated, slips and falls in front of you, you may grab.
What a great move. Who would have created such a move? I want to catch her, and then I want to take the lead. So this might actually be two moves to get us a course up this face, like this hill face. Mm. And I'll roll act quick to catch her. That makes sense to me. But when I take the lead on charting the course here, I want to use one small step. When you venture into unknown or hostile terrain and attempt to chart a course, secure a path, or establish a foothold, discharge this move and roll plus slick. Mm. On a 10 plus, you move fast, stay sharp, and find something remarkable, useful, or beautiful. On a 7 to 9, maybe I save that for the ship. Who knows? I'll act quick.
You can use it. I think, again, the discharge, it will reset for, like, I'll define the scenes, right? I would say that, like, by the time you encounter the ghost ship, I think that would be a different scene. So if you did want to use this twice, I'm not holding you back. Let's do the catching first, though, either way. So I think that is act quick. Go ahead and roll plus slick. We'll see how that goes.
That's a 9.
A 9? Okay, cool. So an act quick, when you use your instincts or reflexes to avoid danger or negotiate through danger toward a goal, you can roll plus slick, and on a 7 to 9, you do it, but you have to choose one from the list. That's your off balance or rushed and have disadvantage going forward. You've left something behind, I will tell you what, or you're pushed to your limits and you suffer one stress.
I'm just going to be stressed.
All right, go ahead and add one stress. Where does that put you on the old stress meter?
2. Gotta
check on you guys. 2? Okay, that's not bad.
I think then I'm going to try to get us up this hill.
So here's what I'll say, right? I think she still takes the harm, but I don't think that she hits the ground. So I was wrong about that. I think you catch the rope and she gets jerked by the stopping of the rope. She still falls 6 feet, but you have her now attached to you and you're carrying the weight of 2 people. But I think if you succeed on this, that will get her up and at least have a pretty material effect on her ability to succeed on that next roll here.
All right. So one small step. That is an 11 plus 3. That is a 14.
All right. You really fucking succeed. Okay.
You levitate.
Listen, if there's one thing I know, it's handling alien creatures in foreign environments.
Yeah. So do you go ahead and mark discharged?
On a 10 plus, you move fast, stay sharp, and find something remarkable, useful, or beautiful. Ask the GM one question about it. They'll answer or will ask you to.
So I want to do that, but I think I'd say in this scenario, you succeed outright at this. So my question for you is, A, how do you make your way up the rock, right? Or how do you get from where you are to carry both yourself and Leela up to the edge of the this kind of like third bubble up where Arna and Mara have now climbed into? And then also, what's your question for me? And I'll answer that.
So Arno, what Arno found was like caves to hide in. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Mara.
It's like caves that Mara had found using the scanner. There's these bubbles at the edge, like kind of almost, I'm trying to think of how to describe this, not just bubbles, but it's like these spherical holes in the rock that is lining this canyon or gorge, right? And some of those, instead of just having a spherical back, open into cave structures inside the rock, and those appear to lead to the other side of the dogleg in this gorge. And that's where you suspect, based on the flight path and the damage to the trees, that the ghost ship is.
How big are these bubbles?
I'd say at least like a dozen feet across. I think they vary in size, but the smallest one's a dozen, and maybe the biggest one is 40 feet across.
So I think what happens is, as Leela starts to fall, her rope is getting ripped down with her, and I notice that, like, we're gonna go down.
Like, maybe it's a series of pitons. It wasn't just two, it's like, ding, ding, ding.
Yeah, and I'm like watching them get. So I think what I do is I look at the rock face, and I see small burrow holes, essentially, in the rock, about molekin sized.
Ooh.
And I just jump for one and grab it. And when Leela swings by, like falls by, I grab the rope and I hold. And I think that's what catches her. It's like me hold, like essentially free climbing.
Yeah.
Through these molekin holes. And I think I swing her towards the rock so she can stabilize. And I think rather than doing like a classic rock climb, we free climb it using molekin burrows.
Okay. I like that.
We are so Tom Cruise.
What's your question for me? Or is it just what the size of these holes are? So I'll give you another one. I think that was a little too limited.
I appreciate that. I, being on this cliffside and looking out at the molekin, I want to look past them. What has agitated the molekin?
So I think what happens is, it's not, you look down the gorge, right, toward the dog leg where it turns toward the straightaway that you're on. And I mean, you don't see anything out of the ordinary other than the sea of the molekin that are now a third of the way down it toward you. And you don't see anything on that path that would indicate to you what might have agitated them. However, because you grabbed Leela and you're holding onto this thing, I think you're almost like angled backwards to hold her, right? Because you had to like grab the rope and sort of leverage or like cantilever yourself on the rock to both hold her and retain the balance. And I think that's giving you a perspective up toward the top of the canyon. Now, like, Lauren had some other roles on her scope it out. I'd given some, we'll come back to the information, but it was including what was my enemy's true position, and I opined on that a little bit last episode. But I think that one thing that you see when that happens is you can see the wisps or beginning wisps of black smoke going up into the sky. So you're seeing that from that position. I think where you're leveraged, it's toward that other side of the gorge, like toward the other side of the dog leg. And you can see this smoke coming up. And I think that's notable to you because that wasn't there before. So you might be like, oh yeah, well, this was the ship that crashed, right? But to the extent that it was, and you would suspect that that's been there for days at this point, at least that smoke, that's new. You weren't seeing that when you were on the top of the canyon and would have had the best vantage.
Got it. Also, was this charting a course, securing a path, or establishing a foothold? Or was it all three?
I think it was all three. So, Nasir, I think you grab the rope and you sort of holding Leela in this position with your other arm on the rocks. Maybe you pull it over your shoulder and you're climbing up to the edge. I think you're able to, in the sort of final move, like swing your body up over the top of the lip of this rock. And you're lying like almost with your back down on the top of that third bubble up, the cave where Mara and Arno are waiting. I think Leela is down, and again, you have the rope. Do you put your hand down to grab her up?
To like help her up? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, to grab her hand.
Once I'm over the ledge, is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I would.
Okay. Is that the first time you've like touched her hand?
Yeah, I think it is.
Okay.
And I decide to immediately use suggestion.
Okay.
On Nasir.
All right, roll plus. No.
Scorpion and the frog. Scorpion and the frog.
Everything's just the scorpion and the frog. Everything.
I can't believe I set up this whole campaign just to get to this moment. That's crazy, guys.
Well, where's the oil? Okay. I'm the villain.
The oil's coming. Don't worry. Or it's already been here. So I think you do that, Leela. I think you're getting pulled up the rest of the way. I think it's still going to require some of your strength to get over this lip. I don't think that Nasir has great leverage to pull you up. Mm-hmm. I will say, I think his success on that move is giving you advantage. But my question is, are you just using your strength to pull yourself up the rest of the way? In which case, that's, I think, keep your cool. Or do you have a different move you like to use to get yourself up? Or suggestion, for that matter. It's up to you.
No, I'm not actually going to use suggestion unless I could suggest the wall to be a little easier to climb, which I don't think is in the realm of what I can do. So probably instead, not. I will do as you suggested and roll keep my cool to try to make it the rest of this way up.
Okay, so go ahead and add an extra die and you can go ahead and roll keep your cool with advantage. That's plus stalwart.
All right, so that's going to be a 9.
All right, so when you attempt to keep your cool under pressure or under a hardship, you can roll plus stalwart. On a 7 to 9, you have to choose one from the list, which is you have disadvantage going forward. You can suffer stress, or you either give up something, leave something behind, or take something with you, and I'll tell you what.
I mean, I think I will make things interesting and say I give up something, leave something behind, or take something with me.
Hmm. So here's what I think happens then. Mo, you had mentioned that those holes you were using to climb up, they were Mulkin-sized or Mulkin-shaped, perhaps. Is that right?
Yes.
So I think as the stampede is moving down the canyon, one thing that you're realizing is actually it's like growing. It's not just that it's moving, it's growing. Because as it passes those holes in the wall, there are Mulkin popping out of them and joining, like they're getting alarmed by the stampede.
Oh, no.
And joining the herd. And I think that what happens is as you kind of pull Leela up, I think that she feels something jump on her back. And I think as you go into the cave, I think you see one of the Mulkin jump off of your back, Leela, and almost like, I think it's kind of like running on your shoulders. It looks, I think, alarmed and scared, I guess I would say. I think you can tell it's kind of terrified.
I think Leela is also alarmed, nay, scared.
What do you do with it kind of on you as you're pulled up to safety by Nasir?
Oh, I flail.
Okay.
And yell. I yell and flail.
I think as you're doing this, and I think it's letting out these kind of high-pitched screeches and is like also flailing kind of joint. I think you can tell that they kind of are copying the behavior, right? Because of the fact that, again, they were like joining the stampede, right? They seem to have sort of social capacity in that way. And I think it's almost like you're sort of getting it to freak out more with the flailing. What are the rest of you doing as you're watching this happen?
I am laying on my back on the cliff face panting because I just hauled both of us up a cliff. Mm. So I am rightfully exhausted.
Lauren. So yeah. My super awesome roll a little while ago gives you advantage on something if you want to help, but I don't know if you have any ideas for how you want to help.
Like what kind of danger are we talking about here?
That's a fair, very fair question.
I mean, do you guys think that you're in danger? That's the question.
I don't think so. I mean, it's one Mulkin.
Yeah.
I think I'm laughing. Literally. Actually.
Yeah, I'm dancing around this, but I think I will say what I genuinely think. I think Mara maybe steps forward, but just like is trying to hold back, chuckling and giggling. These things are like larger than squirrel sized, right? Like chihuahua sized. Like how exactly what is the size we're talking about here?
I thought they were larger than that. I thought they were like medium sized dogs or.
Yeah, I think that that's about right. But they're kind of very flat and wide.
So like a large sugar glider.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's like a dog sized sugar glider. That's a really good description.
I mean, that is objectively kind of hilarious.
Yeah, I'm so sorry. Like Lauren feels bad about what Mara is doing, frankly. there's a genuine disconnect
here. I mean, Haley has felt bad about a lot of things Leela has done. So
fair.
Just to be clear.
If it seems like it's about to dig into flesh or actually attack, I think Mara will try to blow its brains out. No, I think she'll just try to go like grab it or like get it away. But
I don't think you get the sense that it's like you just see it like as Leela's getting more agitated, it's getting more agitated. So I think to the extent that maybe you approach it, right? I mean, do you kind of walk up to her then, I guess?
Yeah.
So I think maybe what it does is it kind of sees the movement and Leela, it kind of scrambles to your back and is kind of like looking over your shoulder at Mara.
Okay.
Like just because she was the most recent thing to move toward you guys.
Yeah.
So I think Leela has been kind of, I mean, freaking out as this Molkin is kind of climbing all over her, and then maybe it shifts to her back as Mara approaches, and then maybe now Leela is able to kind of like jerk her body in such a way that she's able to like fling the Molkin gently off of her, and maybe it kind of is able to land on the ground.
So I think it does that. I think you kind of are able to like fling it off and it gets on the ground, and I think it kind of quickly moves behind your leg, so it's kind of standing behind you as if you're providing it cover.
And somehow I have become its protector.
It seems that way
from the evil Mara.
You're adopting a Molkin.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to be clear. Leela is not a fan of. She's fine with animals over there, right? But then this animal was very suddenly over here. Yeah. And I think that was a lot for her. I do think that after a moment, she's able to catch her breath and maybe turn around and like inspect the Molkin in more detail. And now that everyone is calm, except for, I assume, some lingering chuckles, how is the Molkin? Has it calmed itself or is it still agitated just from the general vibe?
I think you still see it kind of quivering a bit, but I think, I mean, at least the breathing rate seems to be slowing down now that the, you know, your immediate freak out has stopped.
Okay. I think Leela finally summons enough wherewithal to just calmly remark, "Well, they seem to be very empathetic creatures. I guess now that it seems calmer, does it look like it's Is it a friend now? Is it part of the party now?
I think it's just kind of looking at you, trying to see what you do next, is your sense.
Fine, but you have to give it a name, and when it dies, it becomes some sad child's memories.
What?
From Beefy Shotgun.
That was a reference to the other campaign we played.
Damn.
For your dungeon wretches.
All right, but that was Mike. What does Arno say?
Oh, what would Arno the conservationist say? Hold on, wait one second. I have to take this question seriously. Fuck.
What was the exact wording of the question?
Is it part of the party now, I think was the question?
Yeah. I said, is it part of the party now?
Well, as long as you feed it and keep it out of the lab, I don't see why not.
No, there's no guarantee it'll be accepted back into its herd. You should just shoo it away.
I think Mara's going to like lunge at it and make like shout at it.
Ha ha. Get.
I think it jumps back, but kind of takes a defensive posture, and I think lets out like little like kind of like small chirps toward you.
Okay. Perhaps we just leave it behind.
Yes.
When we leave here. And for now, we keep our distance.
I am unfortunately crouching next to it, feeding it right now.
No, this year, not again.
And I'm feeding it some food that's in my pocket from the last Molkin when the Penneth situation happened.
Mm.
We have been over this. This is a wild alien animal. You should know this more than anyone here. What are you doing?
If it becomes aggressive, I'm more than happy to take it out. But I think it's an herbivore. And I'm feeding it plant material.
All right, now you have to roll share expertise so we can see whether that's actually true.
I can see if it's actually an herbivore or not.
That's literally irrelevant. So was a rhino.
So that's true.
You no, please say that in character, please.
So I think my question now is, if this is happening, do you guys move into the cave, or what's the next move for the party?
Yeah, I think that I'm gonna, since I can't dissuade Nasir from trying to Disney princess to every animal that we meet, again, mm-hmm. baffling that this person is the pioneer. Like, the entire galaxy can't be your petting zoo, my guy. That's not how this works.
Very tempted to anyway. Grab it by the scruff and frisbee it out.
I tried to startle it away, but it seems to be uninterested in being startled.
Hmm. I don't Disney princess everything. Some things attack me.
Mm. Yeah, so I think Mara's going to kind of return to charting the most likely path out of this cave system to the other side of the gorge or the other end of the bend to find that downed ship.
So I think maybe, Mara, if that's the case, maybe you're in the lead with your scanner outstretched and kind of have everybody has the topographical images up on their display. And I think you kind of move past the back of this indent in the wall, the bubble, right, and into a narrower passageway. I think inside the crevice, there's the sound of water dripping or some kind of dripping sound. I don't think you see anything that indicates the source of this, though. There's no, like, stalactites or stalagmites or whatever, right? There's nothing dripping from the ceiling, but you can just hear the sound. And I think as you move into the crevice here, into the cave, it's sort of quite narrow and winding as you maybe get 50 or 60 feet in. Certainly small enough where you have to proceed single file, at least at first. The surroundings are mostly dark, save for your lights on your suits, but there is the dim blue-green glow from the lustra that we've described before, and that is getting slightly brighter the deeper that you move into the cave. After a few minutes of walking and kind of several turns, including some ones where you have to kind of go sideways, I think, to get through the crevice, or maybe move your bodies at sort of interesting angles, like put your leg up first to get over a jagged rock that's compressing this passage a bit, the cave eventually opens up into a slightly wider space. My question for you all is, what do we see from each of you as we move into the slightly larger section of the cave? Are you armed? Are you scanning for things? And I don't necessarily have any roles in mind right now, but I just want to know how you're all approaching this or what you're on the lookout for as you move into this space.
I think as long as we're proceeding, I think confidently is the word I'm thinking of, like Mara's scanner is like taking us along a definite route, I'm just going to follow. But I will say that if we reach a point where we're not sure where to go next, I would definitely pull out the drone and have it take a couple of paths and see if like there's any throughway. But otherwise, I'm just following Mara. Actually, just because I don't know what could be in this cave,
mm-hmm.
I will take out my assault rifle. I don't think I'm actively like sweeping the room or anything. I just have it ready.
Like out of ready position.
Okay. Yeah.
Mara, I assume you have the scanner. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely.
What about Leela and Nasira?
So I think Leela has maybe not until now known how freaked out. I don't know if it's something about the size of the animal or like what the deal was, but something about that molekin crawling all over her was not pleasant. And so I feel like Leela is kind of on guard for any more Molkin lurking in the cave. And as a result, maybe is just generally looking out for any life forms. And I could have my scanner out if needed.
We'll come back to that. What about Nasir?
I mean, yeah, I'm like using my scanner or my heads up display or whatever. Actually, I'm not using my scanner because I don't think I have my... I think my scanner was destroyed in...
Yeah, it did get crunched.
Yes. I think that I am, I guess, like, listening and smelling is the way I would describe it. Like, where is there... This is a cave, right? Like, is there something... Do I think there's something in it, right? Do I smell feces? Do I smell, like, biomatter? Is there water? Do I hear running water? Do I hear wind? Like, it's very... analog, like how to navigate a cave the way our ancestors might have.
Okay. I'll come back to some of these things. So I think Maybe I'll start with Leela. So I think you're kind of maybe particularly attuned to movement, you had said, because you're looking out for or concerned about the presence of more of these Mulkin that might get a little too attached to you.
Yeah, it's just more of like a heebie-jeebies, just kind of, she's a little jumpy, I think.
So I think maybe you startle a little bit, because as the cave moves into a longer straightaway, it's maybe a little wider than the other passages that you've been in, and certainly much longer and straighter. You can see some movement toward the back, and it's kind of both on the cave and then also like kind of moves up the wall slightly. And I think looking back toward you on the left wall of the cave, you know, maybe you're like on the lookout for more of the Mulka and you're concerned, but I think that you see two of the glow crawlers, those sort of giant house centipede like creatures, which is the form that evolved on this planet, have these white semi-translucent bodies. And I think you actually noticed like the Mulkin has been, the one that's following you, has been staying close to your light sources and sort of away from the edges of the perimeter where you are. So it seems like they're not used to going this deep into the darkness of the cave, right? They sort of get the opposite reaction from the glow crawlers, or at least, I mean, maybe it's not the light, maybe it's your movement, but they seem to be kind of scurrying away from you.
Mm-hmm.
In the previous times that we saw these, I think at least the last time we saw them, even on this planet, Mara, I think you described a sort of ick reaction when you saw those things. And I'm wondering, is that still the case? Or if not, how has that changed?
I think the ick is still there.
Okay.
But I think there is something comforting in seeing these things now. Out of all the places we've been, right, it seems like they, some version of this, like, end portion of the evolutionary tree is present everywhere we go. So, like, even if she doesn't find it to be the most aesthetically pleasing animal that she's ever seen, bug, creature, what have you, I think that is, it feels a little bit like a bit of continuity in collective randomness.
Yeah.
Hello, darkness, my old friend.
Hello, glue crawler, my old friend.
Try again.
So I think to gawk at you again.
Oh, that's good.
So I think maybe you see them, and I think they kind of scurry down the hallway. Like, yeah, they're kind of on the walls, right? They have the ability to sort of move on those surfaces as well, which I think is odd because of their size. And I think I had mentioned they lit off a kind of bioluminescent glow as well. Or at least they have some kind of natural glow to them, hence the name, I guess. And that darkens the space you're in as they move down the, sort of move around the corner and move out of this cavern that you're in now. And I think that lets some of the natural light come into focus, or the space that you're seeing there. And I think the one thing that, you know, Nasir, you had mentioned you're on the lookout for what you smell. And I think there's a kind of musty smell. I don't think you can really put a finger on it, in fact. It doesn't smell exactly like anything that you've experienced before. I think that's the closest description I would have. But you notice that on the wall of this space, there's a kind of flaky growth. I'd say it looks like some lichen do in our world, but it's letting off a dim glow of red and orange light, which is nothing like the blue-green of the Lustra and that kind of like white-blue of the glow crawlers here. And aside from this lichen that you see, this section of the cave looks very similar to the rest of the passages that you've moved through, but there is one other thing that catches your eye. On the left side of the cave wall, and sort of illuminated by the lichen, you can see a series of what look like cairns, which are these stacks or piles of rocks. But what strikes you about these is that the stones are actually stacked from smallest to largest, with the smallest one resting on the bottom. And it is not clear to you looking at this how these things are still standing.
I am going to approach the lichen first, and pulling out like a small pocket knife, gonna sort of scrape a little bit. Maybe like I have a glove that I put on and I'm just trying to see like the texture of the material.
So I guess my question for you, Nasir, I can tell you what happens when you do what you just said, and that's for free. Is there more that, like, what are you trying to discover with this? I'm trying to figure out if I want you to roll some dice here.
I'm trying to understand if I've ever seen I'm trying to do two things. One, have I ever seen anything like this? Not literally okay. this species, mind you, but something like this.
Yeah, yeah.
And that I can make some inferences. And then the second thing I'm trying to do is collect information that I think could be useful, right? What's the water content of this thing? If it's like a moist lichen, that implies regular water flow, right? I am trying to see if I think this is a thing that needs Molkin in order to propagate. I'm trying to learn what I can to give me information about our environment and see what else I might anticipate because of this.
Okay. Do you have, you have where no one's gone before, so I think that is an option, or you could roll scope it out. I think it's one of those two rolls.
I think it's where no one's gone before, when you encounter a strange new environment or life form and seek to better understand it.
Okay. Yeah, I agree with that. All right, go ahead and roll plus select then.
That is an 11.
All right.
Well, cool. Damn.
So on a 10 plus, you can read the situation with grace and curiosity and choose two from the list. As you discover something crucial about how it functions, survives, or communicates, you can avoid disturbing or provoking it. It reacts neutrally or even helpfully, at least for a time. You can find a useful sample, data, or insight that can be analyzed later, or you impress and endear yourself to it or to someone observing your approach. I guess that is an option.
This plant loves you.
Or someone observing our approach, which could be useful if we're being observed.
Unless you do not want to be perceived.
I mean, my first question is, do we think we're being observed? Not to you, John. That wasn't on the list. To the rest of the party. Yeah. Party, any thoughts?
I mean, by the Molkin.
That's fair. I don't want to... Yeah. Okay, so I think I'm going to pick... I mean, I think I definitely discover something crucial about how it functions, survives, or communicates. Or I find a useful sample data or insight that can be analyzed later. I don't know that there's anything about this cave that it will need later, so I'd prefer to get information about the now. So I think I'm going to choose the now option. Actually, maybe I mean, John, how would you feel if I picked both? If I went for broke on the information.
You can do both. You can certainly do both. I think it's like different things, right?
Yeah, I will do both. I think I will do, you discover something crucial about how it functions, survives, or communicates, and you find a useful sample data or insight that can be analyzed later.
So here's what I think happens. So you said you take the pocket knife and that's how you collect the sample.
Yeah.
And what are you putting it in? Do you have like test tubey kind of things? Sample container? What does it look like?
I have sample containers that we've referenced a couple of times now. And I think one, I like scrape some of it in my glove and I just like rub it between my gloved fingers. And then two, I put like some in a proper sample container.
Okay. I'll get to that. So you go and walk up to it and you go to scrape it with the knife. And I think you like take off a little bit. I think that's where like you get something weird going on, which is from the point where you put the knife in, you see the rest of it rippling and moving away from that point where you cut into it. And I don't think that's quite like what you've seen before. And I'd say another thing, right? The piece that you've removed on the knife, it like stops glowing. But I think you can take that and you put that in the sample container. I think the thing that you notice, though, because this occurred, I mean, there'll be more that you can get on it, I think, if you study it in a more controlled setting, right? Or like use equipment on this. But I mean, it moved because of the cut, like it kind of rippled away from that, right? It seems like, you know, I guess your inference would be some kind of defensive mechanism or just that it like it reacted to it, you know, whether it's defensive or not, who knows, right? But because it moved, I think one thing is that you see the light that's coming from it. It actually kind of like refocuses. And I think that you can actually see that most of the light that's coming from it is shining toward the cairns.
This lichen seems to be networked in some way, and it doesn't like being poked. Also, if such a thing can be focused, it is very much focused on those formations.
What do we know about these formations? They're clearly the result of something's actions, no?
I'm frankly a little more, and only slightly here, concerned with how they seem to be defying the basic rules of gravity.
Yes, that does seem concerning. And I think Leela kind of looks over at Mara as our resident science expert.
I think Mara will just say, she'll literally shrug and go, cause and effect, and try to push one of them over.
Ooh.
Okay. I don't think you have to roll for that, right? I think you just do it. How do you, can you just describe exactly, like, when you say push over, like, using your hand to kind of shove it?
Yep, just...
like, push it?
Yeah, approximately, like, I'm going to start out light, and I'm going to continuously apply force.
Yeah, yeah.
If she starts to have to put her whole body into it, I think she would stop at that point. But if it's, like, pushing over something...
quite the opposite.
Okay, okay.
You go and you touch it. The best approximation I could give is moving a puck over an air hockey table.
Oh.
Mm.
So it's like, it just kind of, the stones just float away from you. And I think as the stones move away from you, and it's, again, from like the lightest touch, right? You see some of them, I think they're even floating with nothing below them, right? It's you can see them kind of levitating on top of this, the rest of these stones. But I think as they drift away from the center, and as it maybe becomes like incoherent, right? As the shape stops being this inverted, like, conical pyramid, right? They start to fall to the ground.
I think I'm going to take a beat and look around.
Mm-hmm.
And if nothing else immediately becomes an emergency, I'm going to say, shall we continue to the sentient, sapient alien life? Or...
I need a minute to compose myself. That was uncharacteristically reckless of you, Dr. Belova. Okay.
Was this sufficient or... oh, okay.
Does anyone else do anything here? Do you all move on at this point?
Oh.
No, I think Leela is sufficiently spooked.
Are any of the rocks that tumbled over, I don't know, say palm-sized or something I could, like, pocket?
Yeah, I'd say, like, I mean, the biggest one is like two times that, right? And the smallest one is maybe like a dollar coin sized, you know?
Yeah, I'll go ahead and take that one.
I think when you pick it up, like, it just feels like a rock, right? There's no indication of the magic, right?
Sure.
I think Mara's going to see this and raise an eyebrow and say, take nothing, leave no trace.
It's a little too late for that last part.
Yeah, I think that spaceship has sailed.
So I think if you all walk out, I think maybe we just see you going around the corner, and, you know, from the perspective of those, and I think there's many of them. If you don't examine them, I don't think you get a count, but there's I think we see approximately a dozen, I'll tell you that, of those cairns left on the side of the room. As you continue moving through the cave, what do we see you all doing, or is there any conversation to be had amongst the four of you?
I was going to say, are we just kind of walking for a while so there it's kind of a bit relaxed, or?
I mean, I think at this point, maybe once you've, you know, continued forward, right, I think you can tell there's probably like another, you know, I want to say like 10 or 15 minutes of this kind of track to get to the other side of the structure. Mm-hmm. I think, Mara, maybe your readings are giving more indications of where you're heading to.
Yeah.
I think if we have kind of a bit of a lull in at least the activity, and it's more of like a mindless trudging forward type of thing, maybe, I mean, do we think, I'm curious, where is Arno in, we're kind of going like, you know, one at a time, right? So where's Arno in the order?
That's a good question. Now that Dr. Belova has knocked over one of those cairns, I went from not sweeping the area to maybe a little more sweeping now that some part of this cave has been disrupted. So I think I'd be doing that from the front.
Okay.
And I do think the cave is a little wider. I'll say that it wasn't the narrowest, like, you have to be one by one. It might still make sense, but it is a little wider. Like, that was only that initial part that you were moving through.
So I wonder if, you know, maybe Mara and Nasir saw something or stopped to, like, inspect something that they saw in the cave, maybe some other life form. And then maybe we're, like, a little separated, but still, like, in sight of each other. And so basically, I think maybe Leela and Arno just get a little bit almost like privacy or a chance to have a conversation.
So I'll come back to that. Before that, I want to know what's Mara and what's Nasir doing then?
As we get, like, deeper in this cave system, do we mm-hmm. see any changes in, like, intensity of the lustra intensity of the lichens? Is there any like waterways that are interacting with either of those two things? That's something that I would be on the lookout for. Okay, I meant to ask this earlier, and I apologize if we talked about this, but lustra is not like harmful in its raw form. Like, are we just getting super cancer right now, or?
I think we had asked about that pretty early because I talked about the lustra in the walls, and I think it's only like, oh, when it's like refined or like condensed, right? It's just that the concentration is so low in the naturally occurring state. It's like just, you know, again, this is kind of these specks in the rocks, right? But it's only when it's like, if it's in like the reactor on the ship, probably not great to hang out there. But if it's, that was kind of where we landed on it.
Yeah, just wanted to you know, reemphasize for everyone else. And also me, I forgot. But yeah, if there's any interplay, because I know that we've already stated, right, that the glowworms have some connection to the lustra. But if there's, if we see any other life forms that also are like vibing with the lustra in this cave.
Yeah. I think the glow crawlers, right? I mean, I guess my question for you, I mean, well, maybe I'll come back to that. Let me ask, and then what's Nasir doing? I will have as many answers to your questions, but what's Nasir doing?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think I'm just keeping the same things I was doing before, right? Keeping my head on a swivel, looking for ways out of a cave, trying to learn things about the system.
Okay. So I think maybe I'll answer your question first, Mara, and maybe, you know, I just want to kind of get the vibes done, and then I have some other stuff planned. I think that you're like, one thing is the lichen, right? That was only in that one cavern.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
Once you moved away from the cairns, you no longer saw it. And I think that did happen to be in one of the deepest parts of the cave structure. Like, I think the further into the rock, like into the cliffside that you go, the heavier the lustra concentration, so the brighter the glow of the walls. But I think you've kind of passed the turning point. Now it's getting darker again, which in a sense is getting lighter, right? Because you're moving away back toward the outside.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Oh, well, at least it's very useful as like a marker that we're not wandering into the depths of this unknown cave structure.
Yeah. I think you're confident like in your readings, right? That you're going in the right direction. I'll put it that way.
We love to hear it.
I do think, like, in terms of the glow crawlers, right, you had asked, like, oh, is there any other life that you're seeing that seems to be integrated with the lustra?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had described some other, like, there was some other growth in, I think it was the cave on Kairos, right? There was, like, some other life that seemed to, you know, I don't know the right, like, interact with the lustra, I'll put it that way, right? Or kind of depend on the lustra. I don't think you see that in here, right? Again, there was the lichen, and that was different. And again, I don't know if there's a lot to be said for the color, right? You know, it didn't give off that blue-green glow, right? There was something different going on about that. Maybe there's a reason for that, and it still uses the lustra. I think we'll have to turn to Nasir's sample to kind of get to the bottom of that.
Yeah.
I do think that in terms of the glow crawlers, maybe I'll turn it over to you. Like, do you think you see more of them? Or if not, like, what's the signs that they've been there, right? What do we think that that looks like?
Are these like are they mucusy or no?
I had not thought of that. That was not like what I had described, but
okay. I like, no, then we're running with they're not mucusy.
For that, I'm
I don't
want
them to be mucusy.
It,
no. That was, I made it look
sound. I think they're mucusy. I think
I think they're moist.
No, please be quiet. No. ick. I got a hard ick here.
Yeah, and I kind of described them again. They're kind of
like
very
excrete something. Maybe it's not mucus. Maybe they just sort of like vomit something.
Okay, this is a mistake, but
never mind. Nothing has fluids on this planet. Everybody's dry. Yeah. Dry as a bone.
I guess like one question. I mentioned they have all these legs. Like, you know, it's kind of like dozens of legs, right? Cause it's kind of this house centipede like creature.
Yeah.
Like, are there like footprints? Like, do the footprints glow? That would imply they do secrete something, but we can ignore that fact for the purposes of the podcast.
We love a good secretion.
Do the footprints glow?
These are like kind of like little trail. Do they have track history on them?
Yes. I'm going to go ahead and say yes. Because I think the glow for these guys is not something like internal. I think they have growths of what I will call bacteria pockets on like their outer portions of their shells. And I think when the growths of these colonies get too big, they kind of slough off and yeah. they leave little bloops or little dustings in certain locations.
Yeah. Okay. I wonder, I guess there's another question. Is that like the glow in the like in the rocks?
I mean, other than, I mean, like, it seems like there's a lot of things that are like.
It's like both. You know what I mean? Yeah, it's part of it.
I'll say broadly bioluminescent here, right? So I think you talked about this lichen that has this particular, like, red orange glow to it. And then the glow crawlers, I'm assuming, is some other color. And then the lustra. So I think if we're talking about bioluminescence, the emergence of that, maybe there was like the inorganic glow of the lustra.
Yeah.
And then things adapted to that glow, and then the presence of one glow begets another glowing thing, and now there's this whole constellation of different glowing organisms.
Yeah. So I have some scenes I want to do with the other people. I think I got the sense that, you know, Haley was positioning for her and for Leela and Arno to have a conversation. I have something I want to do.
Wait,
With Mo. So maybe I'll just give you a freebie, and I don't think this is a role, like another little piece of information about the space you went before. So I think that we had mentioned that, like, with the human activity on these planets, right, or especially with the mining operations, that this can be pretty disruptive to the glow crawlers. And I think that might, like, manifest in the trails. So I think it's like you would know that in the areas where we've been mining the lustre are sort of affecting the environment, right? Maybe they're like the trails, they move away from those spaces, right? Or those are less trafficked. I think that that room, so there was like the cairns, right? And Leela seemed to conclude that that was done by something deliberately, right? One thing that you notice, though, is that it doesn't seem like this has had much of an impact, if any, on the trails of the glow crawlers in this space. So it seems like whatever's causing that, it wasn't really disrupting them that much. If anything, maybe they're like slightly more concentrated in that area. I mean, that's where you saw the two of them, right? So
interesting, yeah.
Maybe now we'll cut to Leela and Arno.
So I wonder if, Mike, you said Arno is kind of trying to be cautious and sweeping. So I think Leela sees that and doesn't want to interrupt his flow, but also like needs to have this conversation. So I think she maybe waits until maybe Arno kind of stops for a moment and then just says, Arno, do you have a moment?
Sure. What's up?
I know this isn't really the time or the place, but consider this the first of what I hope can be a longer conversation. I realized that I've never said. And then I think she just kind of stops for a moment. And then
in that pause, he makes eye contact and he holds it.
I think Leela keeps the eye contact and says, I'm sorry. And I know that's not enough, but I hope you know how sincere it is. And I think she falls silent.
What are you sorry for? I want to hear it.
I think Leela nods and says, to you specifically, I'm sorry for hurting you personally, for making you doubt your reality, and for putting the mission at risk, and for breaking your trust.
I said before that you and I are a lot alike, and I've given a lot of apologies in my day without actually saying what I did. But I'm not going to let you go that easily. It's not enough just to say what happened afterwards. Say what you did.
I think Leela nods again and says, I messed with your head. I made you believe something that you didn't.
You did. And you did it when I asked for your help.
And I don't expect you to pretend like it never happened. I just realized that I owe you at least this much.
I saw what happened when you tried to raise awareness about what you were able to do, how the Sato Institute shut you down, how they tried to discredit you, and I saw how you kept on trying to keep on talking about it anyway. And I believe that some part of you regrets what you did. I believe that you're trying to make it so that somebody else can't do it again in the future. But you have to live with the fact that saying sorry isn't enough, and that I'm probably never going to forgive you. And that's not a reason for you to stop trying to do the right thing. You owe me that.
I think for this whole time, we've been kind of walking and maybe not as quickly as we were when we were focused, but still just walking forward. I think at that, Leela kind of stops for a second, maybe specifically when Arno says, I will probably never forgive you. And I think it looks as though maybe something has physically just popped up in front of her. But after a second, she blinks and keeps walking and then just looks at Arno and nods and says, that's more than I probably deserve from you. I will keep trying.
I think he starts to walk away, just keep on walking ahead. And I think he starts to continue to sweep the cave in front of him. And without turning around, he stops and asks, so when do the visions of the landscape stop? And I'll turn over to you, John.
It's Haley. Thank you so much for tuning in. I hope you're enjoying the show. Okay, now listen in. The rest of the team is expecting me to tell you to share the podcast with, people who would like it or something. And yeah, tell your friends and family. Talk us up at work. Hell, tag us at Worlds Away Pod on social media. But here's what I really want. I want you to share us with someone you think would hate this. You know that person in your life. They get way too into the things that they dislike. They have a critique for everything. That's who I want. Compliments, they're fine. But what I really feed on is the spirit of the haters. Bring them to me. Oh, shoot. Hold on. They're coming back. Hold on. Okay. And you can find us online at worldsawaypod.com. Thanks again for listening. Now, back to the show. Remember what I said. Haters.
So I want to cut over to this year then.
God damn it, Mike.
So maybe you're in the back, and I think that if you're, how did you describe what you're doing? You're just kind of looking more at the environment still?
Yeah, I'm looking at the environment. I'm probably, like, testing walls for dampness. I'm putting up anything that could catch a breeze. Like, just trying to figure out what's happening environmentally.
Yeah. So I think you got your light, like, you have a light that you're shining, right? To kind of survey the wall, get a good view of it, and maybe that's because of that the Mulkin is kind of flocked toward you, right? So I think it's been following. I mean, that and your willingness to provide food. So I think it's been following you.
I think it's my magnetic personality, TBH.
That too. I think maybe you kind of are putting your hand on the wall, testing for dampness, and again, you can kind of hear the dripping sound of water, but the wall is bone dry when you touch it, right? There's no indications of moisture in the cave. But I think as you're kind of listening to the echoes coming through this cave system and kind of like losing spatial awareness of where the source of the sound is. I do want to cut to another flashback for you and pick back up where we left off on Ashara.
Dope, dope, dope. Sick, sick, sick.
So in the last flashback to the time you spent there as a pioneer, we had seen Nasir, Elias, and Han preparing for a mission at the headquarters, as much as it is one, in Boulder Flats. And after several pieces of equipment that were related to efforts to grow crops on Ashara were damaged, the three of you set out for what would be the next location if you drew a line between all of the points of the attacks on a map. And that's a line that is pointing toward Boulder Flats. I think we start the scene when the three of you arrive at this site, which I'm going to ask you more about in a minute. But my first question to you is, how do you arrive there? We previously saw Nasir on the hoverboard, which I know that, as you pointed out, I've been mean and not given you in this campaign yet. But, you know, we did see you riding it in the first vignette, right? But how do you travel on this new planet on the frontier when it's the three of you together?
I think that we have a couple of, to call them ATVs makes them feel bigger than they are. I want to think of them more like, they're sleeker, more like a personal motorized bike, but they've got four wheels and a suspension that's designed for all terrain. So I think I'm on one of these and Elias is on one. But I think Han is like riding behind probably me. We're essentially like two seating on this. I don't think we have three of these things on the whole settlement, especially not early on. So I think the three of us are riding on two sleek, also makes them sound fancy, lightweight ATVs is the way I would describe it.
So maybe we see you kind of like there's like the trail of dust. And maybe that's a little more dense terrain than that. Maybe there's kind of some, like you catch some air a couple times as you're kind of moving over the like bumps and whatever. How does Han react like if you go over a particularly big bump? What's the kind of reaction as he's trying to hold on to the back of the ATV?
I think we can hear him make sounds. I think you could probably like hear him over the dust getting kicked up and the cup being just like, are we sure that ooh, I mean, do we really need to go to...
Yeah.
And it just sort of repeats.
I think we just see like in that like little shot, we just see Elias like kind of shaking his head like this was a mistake or like, you know, what he expected it, I guess.
I have a smile on my face and I'm probably taking this faster than needs to be, but I'm having a good time.
So I think the site, the location that you're going to comes into view. And I think we see Elias kind of slow down and maybe you do as well as the two ATVs come to a stop. Before I get to like what happens as you arrive, I want to ask you also what this location looks like, what this site is. We described it as something related to your efforts to grow food on Ashara, but I want to turn it over to you to describe both like what the location looks like and also what its exact function is in terms of that effort.
Yeah, so I think this is actually where the salt flat meets like a scrubland and maybe even a low forest, where the plant life here is dominated with what I would call like rust colored leaves, like broad leafed plants. So I want like think about like the fall, but not with like the bright yellows or reds, but like a lot of shades of sort of rustic orange and brown. But I think the veining on these plants, on these like leaves, is that same oxidized green and turquoise that we saw on the sort of wild horses on the planet. So yeah, I think in terms of what purpose it serves, I think that since this is where salt flat meets scrubland, this is a place where like salt concentrations are lower and there's like actually an opportunity to grow something. And so what I think this is like farmland. Like I think that this is, we could clear an area here and make farmland out of it.
So I think maybe it's like there's some test fields. Are they like covered? Is there like a greenhouse or glass, or is it just open? What's the aesthetic of the space that you've built? Or is it kind of a combination?
I think what it is that there are, as you go through the forest, there are small sample patches, but they're spaced, you know, maybe 50 to 100 yards apart.
Okay.
So that we can like test different soils. You know, each one is like large enough to grow like a small amount of one test crop, but there are like squares of them everywhere. And I think that they have like little, I guess, ropes around, like they're not like a rope, but like waist height, but think like piton is also the wrong word, but like stakes, that's the stakes in the ground with ropes that are about ankle height, separating them into lanes and squares.
So I think we see that, and maybe it's kind of a gradient of the density of like where the space is. You know, if it's on the edge of the salt flats, maybe it's like how far away you have to be to start getting good crops, or what the perfect like Goldilocks location is. So you have this kind of array moving across the gradient of the terrain, right? You have like different small patches kind of moving in that direction. And maybe in the center of it all, there's a structure. It's kind of a cylindrical, metallic shape. And I think that this is a kind of sensor unit or device, a probe that is getting both water readings from the soil and sort of monitoring the moisture content in the air and the soil, but also just sort of monitoring the crop activity and reporting back to you at HQ. And maybe it's kind of, again, tall and wide and has a lot of different devices on it. Like you can see like antennas or other kind of sensors on the sides of it and kind of jutting up. It makes the top, like the sides are very cylindrical, but the top is has these irregular shapes coming out of it. Kind of sticking up into the air. It's maybe a few meters tall. I think as Elias steps off of his ATV, he walks up to you and slings his pack across his back and just says, "How do you want to do this, Nasir?"
So, John, we have been encountering something has been destroying our reading units, our water collection units.
Yep. I mean, you've not seen it yet, right? It's just been like something's been doing this and this is the next in the line. So it's like, you know, what's the approach that you've got there?
When Elias says that, I will look up through the low canopy, which is probably no more than like a foot or two above head height, like very low. And point to like the tallest sets of trees that I can find that we haven't cleared. We should set up hammocks. We might be here a while. Group them together and set up a cover. And that I actually directed at Han. I'm going to scout ahead a bit. And I think at this point, we're like at the point of the forest density where like we're near the like long cylinder you'd mentioned getting the readings.
Yeah.
And so we're set up just near it. But I would say like 25 feet away, but in the canopy, what, like the canopy, the low canopy.
So I think maybe we, if that's the case, maybe we cut ahead a bit. And I think you kind of scouted around, and I'll just describe it. I think, you know, well, I guess let me ask you this. What was Nasir looking for if you're kind of scouting the perimeter?
I'm looking for tracks. I'm looking for broken foliage. I'm looking for leftover prey. I'm looking for signs of scattered life. I'm looking for anything that's been disrupted.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Go ahead and roll something. I don't know if it's maybe it's either where no one's gone before or it's scope it out.
I think it is.
I don't think it's actually reading. I don't think it's where no one's gone before. I don't think you've encountered the strange life form, right? I don't think that's happened. So you might have a different role, though. I'm not saying you don't have anything on your playbook, but I actually just don't think it's that.
One small step is when you venture into an unknown or hostile terrain and attempt to chart a course, secure path, or establish a foothold.
I don't know if
that's
that
true
either.
Of like, the planet holistically, but not this, I don't
think. Yeah.
I don't think it's contact protocol.
No.
I think it's just scope it out.
Yeah.
But I do think I would use my scanner here.
Okay. I'm fine saying you have the scanner.
Yeah. That's roll with advantage, yeah?
Let me ask this. When did you get the scanner?
I've had the scanner for the whole campaign.
Okay. Yeah. Then I think you've had it here. Yeah, so go ahead and roll with advantage. That's a nat 12.
Definitely didn't need it. It's a 13.
Nice. All
right. It would have been a 12 without the...
So for scope it out, when you take time or use sensitive equipment to closely study an object, situation, or person, you roll plus calculating. And on a 10 plus, your investigation pays off. You can ask three questions to the list. And that's, what's my best escape route, way in or way past? What should I have been the lookout for? What's my enemy's true position? Or what here is not what they seem? Who's really in control here? How could I best end this quickly? Or who or what here could be a useful opportunity?
I think I'm going to do, what should I be on the lookout for? What's my enemy's true position? And who or what here could be a useful opportunity?
So I think what happens is you had left the sort of research site or the test fields, right? And you had instructed Han to set up the hammock. And I think that Elias said, like, he'll stay behind because somebody has to watch the kid, right? So he's going to stick there. I think that you're kind of, again, like, going and surveying the perimeter. You mentioned that you were looking for signs of behavior, right? Looking for broken...
Mm-hmm.
Like plant life, signs of prey, you said, impacts on the ground. Like, I think you're looking for that and you're not seeing anything. I think you approach, however, a sort of low shrub-like plant with those like red orange leaves. And you notice that there is a kind of like, I guess like gray dust maybe is the best way to describe it. And maybe you think it's like some kind of blight. But I think you touch it and it kind of comes off in your hands like a powder. And I think that looking at that, you see that there's a trail of this. And I guess you had kind of uncovered this by moving, I'll say like clockwise was the kind of perimeter you were shaping. And you now see that when you came to this point, a sort of additional radius going back to the center, which is where that piece of equipment is and where Han and Elias are, you see this trail of the dust leading in that direction.
The blight is leading back to our test site.
And I think, I mean, to call it blight, I guess I'll give you a little bit more on that, right? It's like when you touch it, it just comes right off. And I think that you would realize that this means it's both fresh and it doesn't seem to be like an infection on these plants, right? Just something left that residue there recently. And the reason I say that that has to be recent is because like the wind would blow it off over some time, or rain or anything like that would wash it away.
I take off. Running implies like a lack of deliberateness.
Mm-hmm.
I am trying to stalk this thing. Okay. I'm just like moving faster than I would if I was like fully hiding. Like if I was trying to come up on my prey.
I'll give you a little bit more. You'd also asked useful opportunity. I want to describe what you see as you're on the way there. I think you're looking for like the signs of what would have left this. And I think there's kind of two things I'll give you. And maybe it's really only one thing, actually, because it's kind of the two different sides of the same thing, right? Other than this dust, you don't see any impact on the environment around you. You don't see any, like, there's no creatures that have been injured or harmed by this. There's no plant life that's been moved or jostled. And the other thing that's particularly notable, I mean, you don't see any tracks on the ground either, right? The only thing you see is this dust. But when you reach the camp, what do we think we see Elias and Han doing?
I think I've been away for a little bit, and I think Elias is showing Han how to use those like portable fires.
Okay.
That I've described on multiple occasions.
So I think we see that, and I think their backs are to you. And I think that as you approach, it's like the perspective is maybe you're behind some of the, you're coming in from the denser side of the foliage, right? So it's like you're moving in the direction of the woodlands toward the salt flats. And I think you see, like, sort of in between you and them is the device, the sensor. And in between you and the sensor, but closer to the sensor than you are to it, you see something reflecting the light. This creature has thin claw-like legs. It's almost like a spider, and it's moving toward the sensor and toward, also by extension, Elias and Han. The body of this creature is sort of shimmering and reflecting light. I think it makes it hard to get a good look at it, but you can see it in these kind of angled legs moving toward the sensor.
I am going to go to my comm, and I'm going to whisper under my breath, "Han, don't turn around."
I think as soon as you say that, Han turns around.
I mean,
fuck, dude.
Elias, protect him. And I will make a loud noise.
Okay. Well, how do you make the loud noise? You just shout?
I think I'll kick one of the stakes in the ground.
I think when you do that, we see the creature turn around. I think one thing I'll just say again that's notable is it was walking. It appeared to be walking on these kind of spidery, I'm calling them spider-like legs. That's more of just the alignment of the creature. But these legs are pretty thick and wide, right? It's almost I'd say it's mostly imagine a claw machine arm walking on the ground, right? That's what it looks like.
I got you.
I think it turns around very quickly, and I think the sound that makes, it's almost like a 100 chime wind chime. It's like this kind of crystalline metallic noise as it turns toward you, right? It doesn't screech or anything, but it turns toward you with that, and I think it lifts up and makes itself larger, and the claws are kind of extended out toward you.
I will get down on one knee. I'll actually make myself smaller. And there's actually, as soon as I hear the chime, there's a smile on my face, remembering the first time I heard the chime grass on Aventine.
Mm-hmm.
And I am not doing anything. I'm just sort of holding. And I say, "Elias, don't move unless it lunges." I actually want to do one other thing.
Yeah.
I try to whistle and recreate the sound of a wind chime.
Oh, interesting.
And now I think I'm invoking one of my moves.
Okay. So I want to hear what the move is, and I'm going to set up what happens before you take the move. But go ahead and tell me what move it is.
Where no one's gone before. When you encounter a strange new life form or seek to better understand it, roll plus slick. I certainly think I'm encountering a strange new life form.
I think that's right. Yeah, go ahead and roll that. Actually,
I don't think I can combine this with contact protocol because I don't know that I'm seeking information or support from
it. Yeah, I don't just think want that's it to
not attack.
Thing.
Yeah, I just want it to not attack me. That Another is a perfect 12. 12 on the dice plus 2 or plus 3,
what
so
is
15.
Going on this
I don't know
session.
That I rolled below
what
a 12.
The fuck.
Don't worry, we're gonna meet the aliens. I'm gonna crit fail.
I mean, I failed this episode, so that was kind of wild for me.
That is weird.
This is a weird inverted episode.
That's a 15.
So again, where no one's gone before, when you encounter a strange new life form or environment, you seek to better understand it, you can roll plus slick. And then on a 10 plus, you can choose 2 from the list. You discover something crucial about how it functions, survives, or communicates. You can avoid disturbing it or provoking it, and it reacts neutrally, at least helpfully, for some time. You can get a useful sample data or insight that can be analyzed later, or you impress or endear yourself to it or to someone observing your approach.
I am going to do, I get to pick 2. Yep. I'm going to choose, you avoid disturbing or provoking it. It reacts neutrally or even helpfully, at least for a time.
Okay.
And I'm going to choose, you impress or endear yourself to it or to someone observing your approach.
Okay.
I think I have an audience here and it matters a lot.
So I think what happens is, I think we see, you said you made yourself small and kind of reduced your threat level, right? That was kind of what you were trying to do. It doesn't lunge, right? You had said, Elias, don't attack unless it lunges. I think it moves toward you slowly, though. And I think in the shot, right, what we see is we see you kind of standing there and it moves toward you. And then Elias is standing there and I think he is... has his hand on a weapon, but hasn't drawn it. And then I think the kind of focus pulls, and I think we see behind Elias, right? Further back in the frame, we see Han with the gun in his hand. You avoid disturbing or provoking it, reacts neutrally or even helpfully, at least for a time, right? And I think it's just moving toward you curiously. We can hear the chimes kind of as it takes the steps. And then you also picked the last one about you impress or endear yourself to it or just someone observing your approach. And I think for that, I will leave it up to you to tell me what that means and what Han does next.
I think, like you said, Han is pointing the gun at this thing as soon as he turned around because I asked him not to. But I think my comms were to everyone and he heard my instruction to Elias. I think when I start to shrink and this thing starts moving towards me, the kid tenses, right? And he's ready to shoot. And then I think I start to whistle. You had described the creature as making itself bigger when it first heard the loud noise.
Mm.
And I think when I start to whistle, the creature makes itself smaller, just like I did.
Mm-hmm.
As the creature sort of crouches, my eyes catch Han's over its head. And I just ever so slightly shake my head no. I think the kid doesn't necessarily put the gun down, but I don't think he fires.
Okay.
And I think he deflates a little, not because he's like sad, but I just think that a little bit of the tension goes from him. He's like slackens a little bit. I also think that the tune that I whistled was As the Suns Rise Above.
Mm.
Damn.
So I think he has the gun still in his hand, right? I think he's like, it's higher than a 45 degree angle. Does that make sense? It's not down.
Yes.
I think that you can see, I think one, you know, I mentioned these devices kind of coming up the top of these sensors. I think you're hearing the chimes and it's kind of reacting to your humming. And I think there's like a dissonance to it. And I think you notice at the top of the of this device, there's one of those wind meters, right? Like a, it's like a spinning device. And I think it's emitting like a slight ring or noise as it spins in the air.
I reach out to like a wrist unit I have.
Mm-hmm.
That's, think of it like a smartwatch to your slate. And you just see me tap it a few times and the wind meter slows and stops.
So I think when it reacts, I'm going to, again, I'll turn it over to you to tell me what happens next with this. I think there's kind of a couple ways that this could end, and I'll leave it to you to decide which one, right? I think you'd mentioned that when you were humming, the creature got smaller. I think as soon as the noise stops, there's almost like a flux in the creature, and I think it gets very quickly much bigger. And I'll describe exactly how, but I think it's like too fast for me to get into that yet. And I think, again, like I'll ask you, like, what does Han do when this happens? Does he kind of like heed your advice and not react, or I guess like the caution, or does he overreact in this situation?
I think he gets tense and you just hear me say, "Oh no." And I think he keeps it aimed, but I don't think he fires.
So I think if that happens, it almost sounds like glass shattering. And I think what used to be the creature is no longer there. And I think you see hundreds of what look like shards of glass fly away into the air.
Shoot it. I think that Nasir can't help but laugh and like smile in awe.
I think if that's the case, you know, maybe you're like sitting on the ground. I think Elias kind of walks up and then maybe he looks back at the device and looks at you and he's kind of picking up what you did. But I think that Han says, "Nasir, that thing could have killed you."
"We're in its house, Han. Why is it okay for us to kill it?"